T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
One of my side duties, other than being a paramedic firefighter with the city here in Tampa, was I was a member of the urban search and rescue team out of Miami, Florida Task Force 2. And my duty with the urban search and rescue team was I was a canine handler. I had a dog by the name of Marley. She was a black lab. And our job was to try to locate any live victims that may be buried in rubble.
And I take it you must have been one of the first calls then at that point to try and help out.
Yeah, we were, as soon as the attack on the towers was progressing, we were placed on alert. After the collapse of the second tower, I received a call that we were actually being deployed. I packed all of Marley's goods and my goods. We grabbed our go bags and we took off out the door and we headed from Tampa down to Miami. The plan was to load everything onto Air Force C-130s and then fly into McGuire Air Force Base. Once we got to Miami, of course, all of the air flights had been shut down, including many of the military aircraft, and we had to load everything onto semi-trucks and load up into buses, and we spent a day and a half travel. It was a very, very long, difficult trip, but it was one that really was a bit of a blur in light of everything that was going on.
Yeah, it had to be kind of a daunting thought to you guys in that bus for that long to think you're headed straight toward this scene that is worldwide news at this point, and you don't really know what you're getting into.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It was, I remember so clearly because we stopped at McGuire. We had to check in at McGuire and Air Force Base, and when it was our turn to move into the city, I remember coming around, getting ready to come across the river. I think we actually went through a tunnel and into the city, but when we could see, I mean, the first thing you noticed was the absence of the towers. The absence of the towers and just a giant column of smoke was still rising. And we're talking, this was probably the morning of the 13th, I believe it was. So we're a couple of days past the actual attack, and there were still fires burning down below and things like that. So, I mean, the whole bus was just absolutely silent. I mean, it was a solemn moment that I'll never, ever forget. And it'll be, one of those things, that you know exactly where you were at that moment, and you remember exactly, the noises that you heard and the sights that you saw, and it just will never be forgotten.
Definitely. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about kind of the operation itself and what you remember from moving around with your dog there and what you were able to find.
Oh, absolutely. The team got split up into two parts. We had a day team and a night team, and Marley and myself were assigned to the night crew. We worked from 7 p.m. until 7 a.m. in the morning. And, primarily our objective was to try and locate any live victims that still may be trapped underneath all of that rubble. It was an incredible sight because the first shift that I took, of course, there was a security zone that was, several blocks from the actual site itself. And, of course, they would drop us off and we would walk, around some buildings and down a couple blocks. And when you turn that corner and saw the actual site of where the World Trade Center was and all the damage that was done, it was a sight that was unbelievable. I mean, it was one of those things that you could have trained for 20 or 30 years. You would never imagine this type of a scenario. And I just don't know how you would ever train for something like that. I mean, but once you get over that shock, I mean, it's a matter of, separating it into sections, getting together with the unified command system there that New York Fire had going on, and getting assigned certain areas and trying to clear those areas as soon as possible. Because at the time, you're still talking a couple of days into it. It was just the magnitude of it all was just so incredible that you really had to chop it up into little pieces and just take your little area, clear that area, and then move on area by area, and just kind of block out whatever, because you knew that the rest of the site was being covered by other rescue workers and things like that. And, you know, it was one of those things that you couldn't just look at it in a two-dimension fashion. Just you're standing at street level looking at all this rubble. You knew that it went deep down below deck, and it was, you know, stacking up as well. You had fires to contend with that were still burning from automobiles and stuff that were, you know, underneath the street level. And then, of course, we had the issue with the pile compacting. There was so much weight on that pile that voids and spaces that you may have gone to 2 or 3 or 4 hours prior, if you go back to them, they may not be the same type of space, or they may not exist at all, because the sheer weight of all of the rubble from the buildings and everything laying on top of itself was just compacting. So it was just a very unbelievable scene. It was, it took a day or two to really kind of put into perspective exactly what you were dealing with. But I think one of the, you know, if you can take a really great thing out of it all, it was a time that it was unbelievable to see how people in New York City pulled together and tried to assist in any way, shape, or form. And I mean that in the way that, you know, you had a secured zone that was out there, and a lot of the people from New York City would come. They would set up these bizarre type places where you could go and, you know, you could get, if you needed socks or work gloves or helmets or toothbrush, toothpaste, toilet paper, whatever it was, all you had to do was walk to the secured area, the fence line. Somebody would meet you there and ask you what you needed. And if you needed something, whether it was a pair of gloves or something like that, you know, that you couldn't get right away from your team or something, you could go out there and they'd say, I'll be right back. And it wasn't 10, 15, 20 minutes later, these people would come back with these gloves, and they wouldn't take any money for it or anything like that. It was just an unbelievable time to see Americans and the people that lived in New York City come together, you know, for a cause. And it was really an unbelievable thing to experience.
Yeah, that has to be pretty amazing. And to think that, you know, you had your own cordoned off, you had your own kind of zone that you had to stay in this massive pile. I can imagine it must have also been something of a kind of helpless feeling to know that this is such an enormous scene, and it's kind of just up to each individual person to stay in their own little area to do their work in such a massive zone.
Yeah, no, I mean, in order for the process to work right, you had to be dedicated to doing it the way that it was taught to be done. And, you know, you couldn't go out, you couldn't get into other people's areas, because, you know, you don't know what you're getting into. You don't know if it's a stick. First off, the dangers that were involved, you know, typically you want everything to be stable. You want, you know, if you've got a building collapse, you want floors to be shored up before you go searching. We didn't have any of that with the World Trade Center attack. The dangers were incredible. Open elevator shafts. Every day we would get reports of, you know, atmospheric reports of whether or not we had things like phosgene gas, a lot of your different chemicals and cancer-causing elements and things like that. Because they, you know, we had to wear respirators, filtered respirators, during the time that you were actually on site. Well, that was difficult to do when you're handling a dog, because when you're wearing a respirator, the dog can't hear the command. So many times, you know, those respirators had to come off in order to, you know, to control the dog and things like that. But, yeah, you had to be disciplined in all of that. You had to stick to your assignments. You had to stick to what your mission was. And, you know, don't be, you know, you couldn't be distracted by anything. So it was important to be that way for not only the purpose of making sure that you had some type of organized fashion of making sure that every bit of that area was checked, but for safety purposes as well. You know, people had to know where you were in case you disappeared. They knew where to go to try to find you or dig you out if you got caught in some type of collapse or something like that. So yeah. it was quite scary at times.
Sure. And you mentioned it a little bit. I wanted to ask, obviously, with what we're hearing today in terms of health problems, you were wearing a respirator at some points. What was going through your mind about the concerns about air quality there?
Well, you know, to be honest, really, it wasn't a concern. It really wasn't. In light of of the tragedy and the loss of life and the possibility of, you know, maybe somebody else being alive, that really, for rescue workers, it just doesn't seem to click very well. So, yes, we had supervisors that were very, you know, up on their game, and, you know, they made sure we had the proper equipment and everything. And, you know, like I said, for the most part, everybody does the best they can. But there are certain circumstances, and communication is a big part of it. You know, you've got overhead cranes working. You have backhoes. You have the there were a lot of like giant jackhammers that were connected to these big machines that, well, when you're wearing a respirator and you're trying to communicate with a team, that can be very difficult sometimes.
How long did you end up spending on the file? How long was your assignment?
My assignment was for 7 days. With FEMA task forces, you usually have your deployments last between 7 and 10 days, and then they want to rotate you out for a variety of reasons, physical reasons, you know, psychological reasons, things like that. They rotate you out. They roll in a fresh team behind you to pick up and, you know, finish what you had been working on and things like that. But I'll tell you, that's a tough time, because especially in this type of a scenario, because at the end of 7 days, you know, we still felt like the job was undone. And that was, I remember when, you know, we climbed up on the buses again to head back south to the Florida region. I remember as we were leaving the city, you know, the bus got really quiet. Everybody was looking back. You know, it was the same type of a view that we had coming in, but we looked back, and of course, you know, the towers still aren't there. Although there wasn't as much smoke at the time and stuff like that from fires and all, but you knew that, you know, there was still a lot of people that were still missing, and you just felt like the job wasn't done. And it was tough. I mean, there were a few tears on that bus, and although we were tired, although, you know, we very much wanted to see our families as well, it's just not in it for rescue workers to leave somewhere that there's still a lot of work to be done. But, you know, it's the way it was, and, you know, we had done our part, and now it was time to hand a baton off to someone else to continue on with the work and stuff. So,
sure.
But yeah, that was a tough time. That was a tough time. And the bus was quiet for a number of hours, you know, and then finally, you know, the guys, you know, everybody deals with it in their own way. And sometimes just sitting down and talking about it is the best way to deal with it. And, you know, eventually the chatter started on the bus, and we got moving into other things, other subjects. Everybody finds a way that they can tuck it away and deal with it. And you know, we move on.
Sure. And have you experienced any of your own adverse health impacts? I don't know if you can trace it directly to your time there, but anything that you might suspect happened as a result of this?
You know, knock on wood, I suffer some minor ailments that I pretty much chalk up to just age, to be honest with you. Nothing life-threatening at this time, and I'm very fortunate that, you know, that so far to date, I haven't had any issues. Now, Marley, my canine, passed away, I believe, in 2009, and hers was a non-related type issue as well. But you know, I mean, I keep up on with the different programs that are available out there, although I don't participate in them. I keep up on the reports that they get back, and I, you know, I hear about, you know, my exposure to that site was minimal compared to many people. Many people there spent months and months on site, so their exposure was much greater than mine was. I mean, now, with all that being said, it does, you know, it doesn't mean that, you know, I'm free and clear of anything. I mean, that little bug could be hiding somewhere. You know, that big C thing is always standing out there for firefighters and rescue workers. And of course, that was probably, you know, the exposure that I got during that week was probably 100 times more than I would have, you know, have gotten in a year's time here at the fire department. So, I mean, you know, I just don't know what the future holds. All I do is I wake up each and every day very thankful for what I have, and in terms of health and you know, my psychological well-being, and you know, I just keep plugging away. So
yeah, that's good to hear, and hope it stays that way for you. What does it mean to you to learn and know that you were featured on a MetroCard and that your picture is going to be in the hands of many New Yorkers?
Yeah, no, that's I'll tell you, that's something that, you know, when you sit down and you really think about it, it really, you know, when I talk to my wife about it, it chokes you up. I mean, it's, you know, for one thing, as tragic as all of that was, it was a great honor to be part of a group of individuals to try to bring some type of closure and hope to the many people that suffered losses at the World Trade Center. And, you know, we worked side by side, hand in hand with all these rescue workers, you know, during that particular period of time, and you build up a rapport with all of those people. And, you know, when we left the site each of those mornings, there was an area right outside where we would get on the buses outside the secure zone. And there was a large area where a lot of the family members of the ones that were missing would stage, and they would have giant pictures of their loved ones and names. And what we did on several different occasions is we would stop. We would actually stop the bus. We would get out, and the team would get out and just mingle with those family members and those loved ones and stuff. And it was just, I think it was a process. They were able to put hands on us. You know, they were able to pet the dog and see that there was actually somebody that still cared about their loved ones, that were still working hard to try to locate the ones that were missing. And it did them a lot of good. There was a lot of crying, a lot of hugs, a lot of, you know, just thank yous. And, you know, it was healthy for the team psychologically, because, you know, it gave you the encouragement to go back the next day and keep doing what you do. And I think it was good for the family members as well, you know, just to remind them that their loved ones weren't being forgotten or anything like that. But really, I mean, to be chosen out of all of those many thousands and thousands of rescue workers to represent on those cards, it's an honor, you know, that I just don't know really how to explain it. I mean, it's just one of those things that, you know, you wonder why you got chosen. You know, why was I chosen? You know, I was just another one of those, you know, the little people scrambling around trying to, you know, to do the best we can in a very losable situation. But it's an honor. It's important. I think it's important because people need to remember. I mean, it's very easy when the days are good and, you know, you get days that turn into weeks and weeks into months and months into years where you don't have an exposure to an attack such as that. It's easy for Americans to become callous and insecure in what they have and what they do each and every day. But we need to remember. We need to remember what happened. We need to remember why it happened. And we need to remember all those people that we lost that day and all of those people that we continue to lose today because of the efforts of the many brave men and women that, you know, that have ultimately given their lives to try to save others. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's an honor beyond belief. And I'm just, you know, very humbled by the whole thing.
I think you've seen the picture, you know what's in the picture and everything. And
yeah, I got it yesterday and saw it. And it's just, I think it tells the story, you know, the photo in itself just tells the story, you know, with the background and everybody looking tired, wore out, mud all over everything, and it just tells the story.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.